Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Revolution Watch podcast. I'm Kevin, your host. I'm your friend. And joining me, as always, is Stephanie. Steph, how are you?
I'm good. Hi.
And joining us today, also all the way from Singapore, is Darren Ho, our editor-in-chief of Revolution Asia and Australia. How are you, Darren?
Very, very good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for your time and thank you for being with us today. So we brought you in because you recently made an interview with the guest for our podcast today, who is Hannes Pentley, who's a board member of IWC, if I'm not wrong. Is that correct?
Yes, Hannes Pentley. Mr. Pentley is a board member of IWC as well as a spokesperson for the brand. And he has been with the brand for nearly 50 years now. He was one of the most important people involved in the development of the brand's modernization. And one particular thing that he noted in an interview was that he was actually the chief architect of its partnership with Porsche Design back then in the 80s, which led to the development of the first titanium watch and a bunch of other important things that developed following that watch.
So when you met with Hannes and interviewed him, what was there, like how was he in person? Is he down to earth? Is he easy to talk to?
He's a very, very easy conversationalist. Like, he's a really lovely gentleman. He has such interesting stories and anecdotes and very, very important opinions about the industry, which I think are very relevant today. We are in a time of flux, and I think it's also a period where watch tastes and styles are changing very rapidly. Trends are moving as fast as social media is moving, and it's important to have someone who has a longer view of the industry to take a look at these things and say, I think this is what actually matters to the industry as a whole. This is what we should be paying attention to.
All right, great. Well, it seems like it's going to be a very interesting conversation to listen to. So let's just jump into it then.
All right. Hello everyone, we're here today on the Revolution podcast and we have a special guest with us here, Mr. Hannes Pentley, a spokesperson for IWC and a member of its board of directors. Sir, thank you very, very much for being here with us today. Now, first of all, for those listening to this podcast who are unfamiliar with yourself, could you tell us a little bit about your career at IWC?
Well, I started, believe it or not, in 1972 and it was quite interesting because in Switzerland, when you're about 15 years old, you get from your parents or your godfather, you get the first real watch. And I was in a boarding school, everybody got his watch, and only one got an IWC, but we all didn't know what it is. So we said, what the heck did you get? What is this, Schaffhausen? And so he said, boys, if you don't know what this is your problem. And I never forgot that. And then many years later, when I was approached by a headhunter, the job as sales manager for Europe was vacant in the United States. I remembered this that friend that said, if you don't know what it is, this is your problem. So I was interested and I went, I accepted the job. And I thought, well, a year or two in Schaffhausen, which is a small town, and now it's almost 50 years that I'm there.
You joined IWC just about the time when the quartz revolution was starting. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, when I started, actually, I can say with my start, everything went down the drain. So the thing is that when I started, it was peak. It was just before the watch crisis.
In 73, I think IWC registered its best profits back then in the post-war.
Right, and then it really was free fall afterwards because nobody knew what's going on. It was not only quartz watches. Switzerland tried to go around the quartz with the tuning fork watches at the beginning. And we have to say Switzerland was far behind Japan or the Americans, like HP, who had the solid-state watches. So it was very, very difficult then. And that was the most interesting, most challenging time, of course. Very quickly, we had quartz watches that we produced in Switzerland, first this Beta 21, which we financed with other companies. we realized that our future can never be on the electronic side, so we have to stay with mechanical watches. It was a difficult decision then. It was very risky because everybody was talking electronics, quartz, etc. But we decided then we have to try to remain mechanical, and it was, of course, the right decision.
Now, in our previous interviews with you, you mentioned that there were two segments of the market that were very, very important to address in order to survive this crisis. One was that you first started introducing jewelry watches for ladies. Am I right?
Yes, correct. Not only for ladies, but also for men. And you know, the new markets that popped up then was the Middle Eastern market along the Persian or Arabic Gulf, like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Oman, Qatar, etc. A very small group of customers there, very few people had the money to buy that. And they wanted to see I went 5 to 6 times per year there, and they always wanted to see new models. They looked at the collections and old, 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 where is the new stuff? So we made up to 5 new collections, especially in jewelry watches. For men, we had watches in whatever, bi-gold, platinum with diamonds, then the cufflinks matching, the ring matching, keychains and writing instrument, all in the box. And for the ladies, of course, necklace, ear clips, the watch as a set. So this has really helped or saved the company, but it didn't help the factory because very few pieces, and it didn't give enough work for the factory. So then later on, I was lucky I met Mr. Ferdinand Alexander Porsche, and the Porsche design was then very interesting, and we worked together, and that helped then also to bring more and more work to the factory.
So you were the one who sort of helped bring the collaboration between IWC and Porsche together?
Yes, yes.
Why Porsche? I mean, yes, you're completely correct. You know, they were the key design firm at the time. They were doing radical, beautiful products, but they had never done a watch before. So was it challenging in order to bring the two?
Yeah, it was challenging. Of course it was challenging, but it was also extremely interesting for us because from the Porsche side, from Ferdinand Alexander, who is the designer of the 911, of the classical Porsche, he knew new metals, new materials that we in the watch industry didn't know. Titanium, for instance. He wanted a watch in titanium. Nobody knew in Switzerland how to work in the watch business, how to work titanium. We also had to find out the very hard way. You know, in the old days, in those days then, there was a clear separation between manufacture, who made movements, and then Habillement, they did cases and all the rest. So we had our traditional manufacturer of bracelets, and we asked him to make this titanium bracelet. And 3 months before we had the press conference in New York, he told us, I'm sorry, we can't make it. So we had to start ourselves. We found out that dust of titanium explodes. So we had watchmakers with black faces in Schaffhausen. So, but I mean, that helped us a lot. This was very interesting cooperation. And today I can say it. I mean, Mr. Porsche didn't do it to make money. I mean, money, there was enough around in the family. He did it really because he liked the design. He liked things like that. And so we learned from him. And it was interesting sometimes, the discussions, when I said, look, if we could make the dial a little bit different, we could sell more. He said, I don't care. I like it like this. So I think this is also a reason why then his products became really different from all others. He didn't follow any trends, so he did what he liked to do.
Okay, so there's another individual at IWC whom we know about but don't hear a lot about, which is Mr. Otto Heller. He was the gentleman who basically was leading IWC up till when it was acquired by VDO, right?
Otto Heller was the one that engaged me. I had the interview with Mr. Heller when I started at IWC. Mr. Heller was the CFO of the company when IWC was in private hands, belonged to the Humberger family, and he was the CFO. And after, he was the one that called me once, said I have to bring cash, otherwise we couldn't continue. And Mr. Heller for a short time then became CFO and became CEO when we were taken over by Video, by the German company. And so we worked together very closely, and he certainly, I mean, he was a financier. He didn't know too much, of course, about producing of watches or so, but he was a very good CFO, then also CEO, because he had all the relations to the government in Schaffhausen, to the banks, etc. So he was a very important person, but he stayed actually as CEO at a very, very short time, just 2-3 years. I was asked then by the board to take over as CEO, but the fact that I had no idea about how to produce watches, I said, no, we need somebody, we need an engineer, somebody that knows how to produce watches. And that's when we found Mr. Blumlein then.
Now, Mr. Blumlein, he's such a great personality and it's so well recorded in watch history. But my question is really about what he was like before he assumed directorship. What was he like as a colleague, essentially?
I have to say, Mr. Blumlein was a really, really nice man. He was almost, I would say, almost too good that sometimes I was wondering if he would survive in a real big group, you know, because he was really, had a very, very fine character and was a very fine person. Unfortunately, when he changed from Schaffhausen to Geneva, he fell sick and he died very quickly, which was a very, sad situation. At his funeral, I had the official speech, and it was a big loss.
So let's talk about the period of innovation that IWC basically cultivated during and after the first titanium watch. Would you say that it was innovation that basically enabled IWC to survive the quartz crisis so effectively?
Yeah, well, there are certainly several points. As I said, there's certainly the Middle East, which actually saved the company, then the period with the Porsche family. And that gave us the possibility to slowly rebuild the whole classical collection. And that's when we started with the Portofino. Then we restarted with the Pilot watches. And on the 125th anniversary, we relaunched the Portuguese watch. So this was the period, actually, when we built the new basis, the foundation of the company, but still based on classical lines of IWC.
When you were rebuilding the company, when you were rebuilding its foundations, did you set aside any set any guidelines for what you felt were essential to IWC's watchmaking?
Well, I think essential was, and that we realized quite quickly, we have to be faithful to our history, to our way of thinking, to our traditions. I think this was vital. And from that on, we could build. Of course, you can, you also have in a way to follow trends, but everybody tries to be a trendsetter, but you can also be successful by being a trend follower also. But I think especially when I look at the size of men's watches, there's no doubt that we were the trendsetter worldwide with the Portuguese for our 125th anniversary. So I think the guidelines are really in emotional and in the way, in the spirit actually of IWC, which has also to do with the location.
Okay, it's interesting that you mentioned trends and trend setting and trend following. It's because recent trends in watchmaking keep drawing back to vintage watches or vintage styles. Now, but those designs would have been sort of groundbreaking at the time, you know. So do you think that it's necessarily healthy that we keep looking back in the past and thinking?
Well, it's not wrong. It's certainly not wrong. And when you look at the watch as itself, I always say, or quite often I say, it's a very difficult job to be a watch designer, because a watch is round. I mean, I think 85% of the total production of watches is round watches. So to be different, recognizable, different from other brands, so is really difficult. So I think looking back is quite interesting, and I think it's right. And when I look at the pre-owned watches, and strange enough, the watch industry for years and years just didn't care about pre-owned watches. Well, and everybody knew that nobody throws watches away. They're somewhere. They kept in drawers, I don't know where. They were around, but nobody really took care of them. It has changed now since a few years. Before, there were just very, very few people that dealt with pre-owned watches. But now it's more and more organized, and we are also trying to control the market, but control in a positive way, so we don't have any fakes, and that the movements are in good shape, that we overhaul them and give out the certificates like this is the real thing. And I think this is very important, because, you know, there have been so many fakes. I personally have had a collection of fakes. I had about 80 fakes, because it was quite interesting, quite especially in discussions with journalists, said, you have problem with fakes, and so on. I said, look, I can show you the real thing and the fake. And it's quite interesting, because the, as you know, the fakes have become at first sight better and better.
It's true. That must be quite a fun thing to check out the next time I have to ask you for them. Okay, so one thing that we've noticed about social media and the globalization of content today is that trends and styles are being sort of emulated and followed across the board. Everyone seems to like the same things worldwide. Now, do you think that's a problem necessarily for the diversity of watchmaking? Does it allow, a brand to produce a surprise product? Does it make it stand out more, or does it make it harder for it to be discovered or recognized?
I think, you know, everything has become much faster. I mean, especially with all the possibilities you have today to communicate. I mean, you cannot keep anything secret. I mean, the moment we show something in Schaffhausen, a few seconds later you have it in Singapore, you have it in New York. So, I mean, everything has become much faster. So it's also more challenging, I would say. And I think to be different from our competitors or so, it's more the way we treat our customers. We created a certain family spirit, you know, and of owners of IWC, and we have the statistics that every owner of an IWC has almost four IWCs, which shows that we have a very faithful group of customers, and very proud of that.
Okay, I'm just going to go back a little bit to LMH back then and talk about the people who were working there at the time, because there were so many talented watchmakers that had been discovered within the LMH group, that came on board the LMH group. Everyone from Richard Habering to Anthony de Haas, etc. What was the atmosphere working in LMH like? Was it very energetic?
Well, I think it didn't change much. when you look at the, people like Harbouring, etc., who started their own business, made a few watches or so. He was a very good watchmaker, of course. But character-wise, he was certainly the type who prefers to be on his own, do his own thing, and so. And there are different characters. And you see in the watch business, especially in the area, in the centers of watchmaking, there are always one or two people that just want to be on their own. They don't like to work in teams or so. They do their own job or with their wives, some of them. And I think this will always exist. Always exist people who are individualists who like to do their own thing. But I think it doesn't have so much to do with the atmosphere that was then or differs much from how it is today. Even today, I'm sure there will be people who will try to do their own thing, startups, new things in watch business, which is not easy, but there always will be people that will try to work their own way.
So I just have one last question. What do you think the Swiss watch industry has sort of learned from the quartz crisis that it's making sure not to repeat so as to prevent another
crisis.
Future crisis?
Well, I think, normally we say people never learn from history. So, you know, this, and I, at my age, I can tell that. You tell sometimes another generation said, oh, don't do it. We tried before, so they will tell you, oh, well, today everything is different. No, that's completely different. When they realize that something doesn't work, they say, yeah, you might have been right. Because basically not so much has changed. The big question, of course, that comes regularly is now, will young people in future also wear mechanical watches? Everybody talks about smart watches and things like that. But I always say, how often do you change your iPhone? Probably every year, every 2 years and so. So that's a completely different thing. And I think the same happens with smartwatches. You don't have a smartwatch for 15 years or for 10 years. And so it's completely different business. To buy IWC today is certainly not to have the accurate time. It's more, it's emotional and so, because accurate time you have on your iPhone, you have it in your car, on your microwave oven, you have it everywhere. So, I mean, it's more an expression of yourself. You said, I like the mechanics, I have a certain relation to my watch. I remember we had an advertising once about a manual watch, which is not logical at all. You have automatic watches, why should you wear it every day? But the headline was, this man is dangerous. He winds his watch by hand and thinks in the morning when he wakes up, he takes a watch, he winds it, and he starts to think about time, about the day that is ahead of him. So it's a philosophical thing. And I don't think, coming back to your question, that we had to learn a lot, that something can never happen again. My grandfather always said, somebody who tells the future, he lies by 50%. So, I don't know, I think because the product, the watch, has become something completely different than in the old days, we don't risk so much.
So it's on firmer ground. You see the industry is on firmer ground.
Yes, I would say so, yes.
All right. Thank you very, very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
All right, and we're back. So that was the conversation between our editor-in-chief of Revolution Asia and Australia, Darren Ho, and the IWC board member, Hannes Pentley.
So the reason why Hannes Pentley is in Singapore is for the Spitfire collection, which is IWC's focus this year. They also actually helped restore a silver Spitfire plane from 1943. So the longest flight is a 26,700-mile journey around the world, piloted by Steve Boltby-Brooks and Matt Jones.
Yeah, so the two pilots were embarked on a journey with the restored plane, and obviously because it's an old plane from the 1940s, the range is quite limited. So they only have a range of 1,300 nautical miles, so which means that, well, it's good for us because they're going to be doing lots of different stops around the world to promote the Silver Spitfire. Obviously, IWC will promote their collection at the same time. But it's just funny, it's just very interesting, you know, for the people to see an old warplane restored and flying across the world, I think.
Yep, so stay tuned for a lot more stories on the Spitfire's journey around the world on our website and, I guess, around all the watch blogs as well.
Yeah, if you're around the location where it's going to make a stop, make sure to you know, find some time and go check it out, because it's not all the time you see, you know, an old plane like this. And it's a proper, like, you know, silver, like it's all chromed.
Yeah.
So it's really cool looking, yeah, as well.
It's cool that they restored it and also made it actually airworthy, like it does fly. Before we sign off, I just wanted to tell you guys to stay tuned on the revolution.watch website, because we have quite a number of exclusive stories coming out. I don't want to share too much, but just, you know, keep an eye out.
Teaser. We're just teasing you, right?
Teasing you with nothing.
So go check out our website. No, seriously, like, we have some exclusive stories coming out soon, and they're very worth checking out. So keep an eye.
Until next time.
This has been the Revolution Watch Podcast. I'm Kevin, joined with Stephanie, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.